You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, this is Jay Harwich with a special edition of Amazing Conversations with Steve Dillon Sr. and Steve Dillon. This podcast will air on 9/11. You know, it's a time of reflection for most Americans, but especially you two gentlemen. Steve Sr. was in the police force for 21 years. Steve Dillon Sr. was in 25 years.
Yep.
Also served at Ground Zero and the Staten Island land kills and the NYC morgue. Again, what does it mean to you as we get this time of the year, 9/11? What does it mean to your family?
The day of 9/11, I was working in Plainview, private security, and we had the TV on and we heard about the Twin Towers. And the first thing I thought of was my son being, you know, working in Manhattan, wondering where he was, what happened, the questions that I couldn't have answers to. So I went up to the roof, which was a small roof of the building I was working in, and I could actually see the smoke coming from the Twin Towers. Yeah, I couldn't believe what was happening. I didn't want to believe it. I was like in denial that this was an attack from a foreign country. But as far as the family part of it, my son was a major priority for me, knowing
when did you find out he was safe?
I think it was that night, because we had no communication.
Where were you, Steve, that day?
So that morning, I was home. It was actually my day off. I was actually scheduled to go into court that day, but they'd canceled it before I appeared. So I was home watching TV, and they were talking about a small plane hitting one of the towers. And as I was having coffee, we witnessed the second plane hit the towers. And then after that moment, I got a phone call from work saying to come into work, to head into, at the time I worked for Manhattan Special Victims, upper Manhattan, 3280 Broadway. So I jumped in my car, I drove in, got in uniform. We went right down to Ground Zero, and it was just total chaos, you know.
How long were you there, Steve? Did you arrive after the plane hit?
So we got down there. I got down there, I guess, just after the second tower collapsed. So sometime before noonish, we actually made it down there. They made us go into work, get into uniform, and then head down.
So when was the first time that you heard from
Steve? I believe it was that night. we were able to, I don't know how we made contact, whether it was landline or what, but when I heard his voice, it took a load off of my mind. And then I was asking him questions, same as you're asking him, what was going on? It was really chaotic, what was going on down there. And I ended the conversation by my son saying that he would be coming down here more often because of the catastrophic problem that they had down there with the buildings and trying to locate all of the firemen and the police. It was a night that I would never forget.
Steve, how long were you at Ground Zero for? You said about a month or so?
So I was down at Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan for the first 3 or 4 days. And then that following Monday, they opened up the Staten Island landfill. So all debris that was being carted to Staten Island from Ground Zero was now being laid out, and we had to sift through all of that rubble.
I got some numbers for you.
Sure.
1,600... Over 1,600 personal effects, 1.6 pounds of rubble, close to 5,000 human remains. But after all of that, they only unidentified 300 people.
Yeah.
I mean, how tough was it to be doing what you were doing? You know,
it was very tough. The first load from Ground Zero, when the truck dumped the debris, you could smell like the the flesh, the decaying flesh. There's a distinctive smell that you'll never forget. You smell that, so you knew it was within that pile of rubble that they just dumped, and you would sift through it. The thing was that when you were sifting through, everything was covered in that dust, so it didn't look like it was human remains. It looked like it was a ball of dust or dirt, or actually the way we like to describe it was, it almost looked like wet carpet, you know, that had been plastered with this dust.
You told me you found a femur on your first
yeah,
day.
Yeah, so the very first day, the largest piece of the human body we found, and we don't know if it was a man or woman's, was it appeared to be somebody's leg, their femur, from the knee up to their hip. From that point forward, it was small amounts of skin, fingers. It wasn't anything substantial.
Remember when the first attacks first hit, everybody thought, well, there'd be a lot of survivors, but there were no survivors, really. I mean, it was one or two people pulled out, remember?
Yeah, so that's because I was in the investigative field. I was a detective at the time. They had us rushing to hospitals the second day to identify people that were going to be brought in. But you're right, there was nobody brought in.
Steve Sr., did you think your son would follow in your footsteps and become a policeman?
I didn't know where Stephen was going, because he got out of high school, went to college a little bit, then went into the Navy. So he did a lot. When he came out of the Navy, he was trying to find himself. And I had a friend that I had worked with in the precinct that I worked with, who was the director of security at a local hospital. And he called me because he knew Stephen and knew of Stephen and my family. And he said, how is he doing? What's he doing? And I said, right now he's just jumping around. He said, well, I have an opening in the building for security. And I said, well, I didn't think of him for doing that, but I will bring it to his attention. And he said, I'll give it a shot. And that's when it all began. He went down to the hospital, became a security officer, and then he promoted to a corporal.
Yep,
a corporal.
Yeah.
And he was on his way. And it's funny that when I retired in March of 1990. He went on in October.
Was that by coincidence, or you planned it like that? Or?
No.
I had waited 3 years to get on, because it was when Dinkins. It was the cuts. Yeah. So it took me 3 years to actually get on. So I think he was waiting out. He was waiting for me to get on, right. and then once he knew that it was going to be that same year, he then retired.
So I just missed him. We could have been on the same New York City Police Department at the same time. But when he graduated from the police academy, he graduated out of Madison Square Garden. He came over, and the first thing I said, let me see his shield, because he took my shield.
It did, right?
Yeah, he took my shield, and I said, let me look at that shield. And I knew with the markings that I had on there that it was the same shield, you know. So he carried it for the next.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
25 years.
Do you find that in time, this is the 23rd, right, 22nd anniversary.
Yeah.
Do you think people forget a little bit? It doesn't have the, I just bought a press coverage and stuff. It doesn't seem to be as front out there as it was before. Am I wrong? Or I mean, it just, something doesn't seem like it was before.
I agree. I spent probably 10 years going back. I used to drive one of the widows of one of the guys that was killed. And every year going back, it was like reliving it. This, you know, year after year, it was the same as the previous year. Nothing had changed. But I think now it is a lot different. I think people tend to forget, and you're right, it's two decades later, and people, you know, like my kids, they know about 9/11, know I was there, But their generation, you know, it kind of fades.
You know, Steve, well, I've been here with the Mets long, 44 years, and one of the things I'm most proudest of is what we did around that time. You know, the Shea Stadium parking lot was recovery area. We made constant trips down to Ground Zero, to the firehouses, to the police stations, you know, and we had the perfect team. That team was, you know, Leiter and Franco, Zeal, Ventura, Piazza, Alfonso. Those guys got it, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? We did. I mean, if I had anything on my legacy to be a part of that team, I mean, did you? I'm sure you're aware of what went on before.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
What the Mets yeah. did for.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think when you show the first game after 9/11, right. yeah. That first game when everybody wore the different hats.
Hats. Yeah.
I think that is an emotional.
Right.
Time of the baseball season, that if when you show that, it brings all the emotions back. You need something like that for the people, the younger generation, to understand, you know, what happened. Same as for, I'm sure my son doesn't know about Pearl Harbor as much as I do
sure.
because of the generation gap. You know, my father was in the Army. He talked about it all the time. So the 9/11, the longer it gets, the shorter people remember.
Right.
But for you and for the people, like you said, Piazza and the boys, when they come forward and show the emotions that they did show, I think it helps remember.
We went to a firehouse the other day with Mike, and you see the firemen still appreciated Mike being
oh, yeah.
there. And,
yeah.
And, yep. and they had this particular house that lost 9 guys. I remember getting a call right after probably the 25th, and we wore the hats. I think the court officers lost 4 people.
Yep.
And one of the widows of the court was so thrilled that her yeah. husband's memory. That first year, we wore a hat for everybody who lost an agency who lost somebody. So it was our way of. And I know we're going to do the same thing. I think we play the Diamondbacks. The Diamondbacks and the Mets are still
right.
you know, wear that. But I want to digress to baseball. Your dad was one of the stars of the old timers. They
yeah,
79 years old. How many did you pitch an inning?
I pitched 2 batters.
You pitched 2 batters.
I pitched Daniel Murphy and Mookie Wilson.
Wow.
And they both should have been out.
Yes. I forget what happened.
Mookie hit a ball that, you know, the left fielder was playing a little in because he didn't
right.
think they were going to hit. And it went over his head. And then Daniel Murphy, he hit a bloop when the outfielders moved out either because he's a little bit younger. They moved out. He blooped it in. So,
how proud of you of your dad when he went?
Oh,
dad.
Very proud.
Yeah, as I told you before we got on here, that game changed my life.
Why is that? People?
They're writing me, asking me to come here. They don't know what I did. They just know what I did that day.
Right.
But they didn't know 60 years ago that I originally signed with the Yankees, and I won 15 games in
right,
the minor league with Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
So from that, the Mets grabbed me, and I played 4 years with the Mets. But I didn't have a long career. But
was it 3 games?
But I did fulfill my life child's dream of playing in the major leagues. So that went dormant. I became a police officer.
Right.
They heard the police officer, they wanted me to play for the PBA, the baseball team. I did that. So it was something that was carried on, but my children never saw me pitch off a professional mound in the major league baseball field. So when this happened, and when I said to you when you called me the first time that I'm in good shape, I can pitch.
You're in great shape.
You couldn't give me any definite, and I understand. And the day of the game, I was in the clubhouse with Willie Randolph.
Right.
And I hadn't met Willie ever, so I went over and introduced myself. And I told him that I was with the Yankees that one time. And that started the ball rolling.
Yeah.
So and I talked to him for a little bit. But before we ended, I said, Willie, I said, I know you can't guarantee me, but I'm in good shape. If I can throw, if you can get me in there, I'll be more than happy to.
I read a story. I don't know if it's true or not. Did you gave up a home run Davida Pinson in 64.
Oh, where did you hear that story?
And then when you came back in, they broke something on the scoreboard, right?
Oh, come on.
Casey Stengel said, if you give him another home, do you have to pay? That's a true story?
Exactly.
Really?
Exactly.
This is what happened with Otani this week. Well, he broke something on the scoreboard
I pitched against Cincinnati, and the batters, I pitched two innings. I faced Pete Rose, Tommy Harper, Frank Robinson.
That's pretty good company.
Yeah, and I got them out. The next inning, Vada Pinson came up, and I had a 3-2 count. I can remember it.
Remember the count, 3-2. Huh?
Oh, yeah, I remember the whole thing. And I said, I'm going to fool him. Man, that's how a pitcher thinks. I threw him a curveball. Well, he hit it off the scoreboard. So I came in, Casey's here, and I go down to the other end of the dugout. And all of a sudden, I hear, hey, Dylan, come on down here. So I said, oh, here we go. He's gonna give it to me now, you know. So I come down and in front of a lot of ball players. If another ball goes off that scoreboard and you break it again, you're paying.
So what did you say?
I just said thanks, Casey.
What kind of guy was Casey?
Oh, he was phenomenal. He had such knowledge of the game. He wasn't able to had the mobility. So Wes Westrum, I don't know if you remember that name.
Number nine.
Yeah. He used to be his right-arm man. He would help you, teach you, but it was coming from Casey. He was a wonderful, wonderful instructor. I'm just diverting a little bit because I want to tell you another story. I was out, first year was with the Mets. They asked me to do a little speaking engagement. So I went around the Bronx and everything. And did some speaking. I went to a dinner one night, and Phil Zulu was supposed to be there. Duke Carmel was there. I think Eddie Cranepool was with me. And we were all talking, and all of a sudden I hear I don't know who he was. And he's talking, he's talking down on Casey. So I say to him, who are you? And he wouldn't answer me. I said, when did you play baseball? Well, tell me who you played for. What did you manage? I didn't do any of that. I said, well, leave Casey alone. I was really upset.
Yeah, yeah.
The next day, I find out, Howard Cosell.
Really?
Wow. That was Howard Cosell.
Pretty good story. See, wasn't meant to see your father so happy, and he threw out a first pitch this year at 80 years old.
Yeah.
What has it meant for you and your family to see your dad?
It's been great. I mean, most of his brothers and sisters, my brothers and sisters, my kids were there to witness it. So, you know, I'm just fortunate enough that, working for the Mets that I can, get to experience it, up close and see him enjoy himself, first pitching in the game and then second come back for the first pitch. It's priceless.
That's one of the side benefits of the Alzheimer's game. It's great to see the strawberries good. But for me, the three stories that stand out were your dad's story, John Stearns, mm-hmm. willed himself to come back.
Yeah, John Stearns was
willed himself to come back
in the clubhouse.
Yeah, he took ground balls at first base, and a month later he passed.
Yeah.
I had heard from his family when he got back home. He gave it all the air. And Frank Thomas,
Frank Thomas.
He fell and broke his neck, came to the game. And passed away that December. Yeah. Wow. Those, to me, are the stories that make it all worthwhile. And the reunite with the friendships. You saw, Cranepool and Shansky, some of the other guys you played with.
Eddie and I played minor league baseball together. I mean, high school baseball together. I wanted to tell you about, you mentioned Mike Piazza, another human side of Mike Piazza. When I went to the luncheon, he was the first guy that I introduced myself, because they really didn't know who I was.
Right.
And I walked up to him and I said, Mike, Steve Dillon, 63-64. Steve was so happy that you are here. We're happy with how you start. He was like, I'm part of the family.
Yeah.
Here's Mike Piazza.
That was
made me feel really.
That's one of the things, the benefits of my job is bringing people back in the family, and reuniting. What do you think? What will you gentlemen do today on 9/11? Anything special, different, or
I generally don't watch this the reading of the names anymore. It's just.
And why is that? Is it too much or?
It was. Like I said, I drove one of the widows down for 10 years, and finally after the 10th year, I had to tell her I can't do it anymore. It was just, it brings you right back to it every year, and it was just too much for me. So I'll have a normal day, and I'll come here and then enjoy the things the Mets will do for that day.
And one last question, when did you, going back to the times you were on in the pile, there was so much hope in the beginning and finding, I mean, when did you really first realize this is just not going to happen?
When you weren't finding anybody, when you know, there was the distinct sound of the Scott pack, the sirens that were going off, that ringing noise. And once that finally died down, you realize there were tons of pounds of rubble on top of people, and they just weren't coming out.
The other thing I read, see, correct me if I'm wrong, people fear there's still remains that haven't been found yet. Is that true, do you think?
I think so. And it's like I described at the landfill, you know, you're sifting through things, and eventually it went from big piles to little piles to piles on a conveyor belt, and you couldn't tell if it was a piece of flesh or not because it was so dirty. So, I truly believe there are still remains probably somewhere in the Staten Island landfill.
What do you think you're going to be doing tonight?
We still listen to my wife. We had a neighbor, his name was Michael Kelly. His wife is still in the neighborhood. He was working for some financial investor. he was never found. And we watched the names. Now that I'm retired, I can watch the whole thing. And we just reminisce on it. And my daughter, Christine, is a close friend of this, the wife of the gentleman that died. And we'll call her and see how she's doing, the wife. And
right.
It brings it all back, like my son said. But it's a reality that there.
So the woman he's talking about, Joe Kelly. Her husband was killed, Cantor Fitzgerald. So the following day or the day after, we had put together these packs to collect DNA. So I actually drove out to her house, collected toothbrush, hairbrush from, and I believe 7 years, 8 years later, they found his remains.
Really?
Partial remains, yep. Yeah, so they were able to tell her that, you know, his remains were found.
It's not perfect, but it's great, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we were also assigned to the armory on Lexington Avenue. That's where all the, I don't know if you remember seeing people having the pictures of their family members saying missing, and they would come there and we would tell them.
They had the little billboards and stuff.
Yep, and they were told to come with some piece of toothbrush, hairbrush that had DNA on it so we could take descriptions and put that in, and that's what went to the morgue and sat until they found, they would check it against every piece of DNA that they had.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your time. I think you promise you'll be pitching the next old-timers game?
I'm ready.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Steve, as always. Thanks, man.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Got it.